You know what that sound means. It's Second Friday, 11 a.m. This is the Digital Divide. We're going to bring you a little more than half of a deep and far-ranging debate on net neutrality and the future of the internet. This is a topic that bears deep research. So, if perhaps in your search for the rest for the entirety of this debate you find other resources, all the better. We're working on getting you the exact resource. Meanwhile, here's what we've got for you. Check it out.
It's just another day on Earth.
Thank you, Claire. Good evening, everybody. Can everybody hear me clearly? Oh, now I hear myself bouncing off the back wall, so the answer is yes to that. Thank you very much for coming. I just need to make one very quick note. I was advised by somebody who was very careful to tell me this, that the shade of my necktie disqualifies me as actually wearing Northwestern purple, so I'm sorry. I tried. And interestingly, my son attends the University of Chicago. I think actually some of his classmates may be out here. I'm not sure. But give me credit for not wearing maroon, okay? I just want to chat very briefly a little bit about the culture of Intelligence Squared. Our goal is to raise the level of public discourse by doing these debates. We are counting on you to listen dispassionately and critically and really with an open mind and be willing to change your mind if you hear an argument that's persuasive enough, but to listen in that way. Clea has asked you already to vote. We have you vote a second time at the end of the evening to see whether minds have been changed or not. Clea also mentioned that we live on as a radio show and a podcast and as a television program on the cable channel Newsy. And for that reason, I want to let you know that a lot of people will only experience this debate by hearing it. And for that reason, we are absolutely delighted and in fact encourage you to give voice to your reactions to things you hear throughout the evening. If you like a point, we're absolutely comfortable with you applauding it. The opposite, however, is not true. We do not want to hear any booing and hissing. I mean, I think at most a sort of sardonic chuckle is passable, something like that. Maybe a very mild groan. But we really, it's not the spirit of what we do to hear booing and hissing or shouting out. But when it comes to shouting out in the middle of the debate, I'm going to come to you for questions to the debaters. That'll work in a very, very simple format. You'll raise your hand. If I spot your eye, I'll call on you. We'll ask you to stand up. A microphone will be brought to you, so please wait for the microphone. Again, that's for the people who will hear this rather than see it. And then we ask you to tell us your name and then to ask a question. And I do have to say this. I'm pretty strict about really wanting you to ask a question. I don't want you to debate with the debaters, but to ask a question that gets them to debate even better and even more deeply on the topic that we're discussing. So it really also has to be on topic. So think in terms of what the motion, the resolution is that we're arguing, and does your question fit what they're saying? And I can give you about 30 seconds to get that out. After that, I'll have to interrupt you and ask you to move on. So try to be really terse. And the reason for that is we have limited time. In terms of asking a question, make sure that what you ask really is a question. So if whatever comes out of your mouth naturally has a question mark at the end of it, if that feels natural, that means you've nailed it. That is a question. So that'll come in the middle section. The final thing is, because of the number of breaks that we have to do when we actually edit this into the radio show and the podcast and the television program, you're going to sort of see the sausage being made. You'll hear me say things like, I'm John Donvan, and I'll be right back, but I will not have gone anywhere. I will resume immediately. So if you see things like that, it's not your head, it's what's happening on the stage. And speaking of on the stage, I really would like to welcome to the stage now two of the gentlemen who, for us at Intelligence Squared, represent a superlative partnership that we have with the Newton-Joe Minow Debate Series and with Northwestern Law School. This is our second time working with them. It's one of the best partnerships, the most productive, fruitful, and just pleasant to work through that we've ever had. So I want to welcome to the stage Dean Dan Rodriguez and Newt Minow. Thank you. Thanks, Dan. So we're just going to chat for a few minutes, just a little bit about the thing that I just said, this partnership, the relationship, the value of debate. So Dean Rodriguez, tell us about, in a sense, why we're here and about the Newton-Joe Minow Debate Series.
Well, thank you, John. It actually started with an outpouring of interest on the part of many individuals, including many in this room, and I have to have a special shout out to the lawyers from the Sidley Austin Law Firm to find a way to honor two of the great Chicagoans and great Americans, Newt and Joe Minow. And that morphed, or I should say evolved, into a way of honoring them, and we came across the idea of doing it through a debate, which is entirely appropriate given Newt's extraordinary career. I should say that Newt and Joe are two of our favorite people, and as far as I'm concerned, I don't care whether it be a rodeo, a circus, or a parade, we'd find some way of honoring them. This is not a rodeo, a circus, or a parade, it's a debate series, and we're just very, very delighted to be able to support this initiative here at Northwestern and working in partnership with Intelligence Squared.
Well, you guys have been great partners, I just need to say that. And in terms of debate, obviously, Newt Minow, you are the driving force behind the tradition, now the tradition, it wasn't when you started it, of presidential debates. You value debate, you thought the nation needed that. And given that we're going at net neutrality, which is an intersection of communications and technology and democracy, back in the period when you joined the Kennedy administration, chairing the FCC, were the concerns the same, basically the same, or were they dramatically different?
It was a very difficult time. President Kennedy's predecessor, President Eisenhower, had to fire the then chairman of the FCC. There were scandals. There were scandals in the industry with payola, with the quiz scandals, so the place needed a good cleaning up, mm-hmm. and I was sent there to do that.
You famously, I'm sure you know what I'm going to quote to you, when you famously referred in a 1961 speech to broadcasters about television, which you described as a vast wasteland, what were you trying to get them to do?
I was trying to get them to take hold of the enormous trust and responsibility that the government, the American people, had given to them by giving them a free license to use public property, the public airwaves, and their obligation under the law to serve the public as well as the private interest.
And we're in a time now where communications is largely shifting over to the internet, not completely, but do you see this as a similar kind of inflection point, given, again, what it means to be a citizen, what it means to be a citizen who has contact with this vast system called the internet?
Well, I do, John, particularly as we saw last week with the hearings in the Senate and the House of Representatives with Facebook. Obviously, the public interest as well as the private interest and the issue of personal privacy are going to become paramount issues in our time. And we as a society, as a country, are going to have to find some way to preserve the public as well as the private interest. And there'll be great debates that you'll be having here with Intelligence Square about how to do that.
Well, why don't we stop right there and launch our great debate? I want to thank the two of you again for this partnership and for the remarks you just made. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Did you want to say something?
I'd like to tell particularly the students, there were three Northwestern law graduates, Dick Wiley, a Republican, Henry Geller, an independent, myself, a Democrat, who changed the law, I emphasize, changed the law to permit the presidential debate. So work hard on it, and we learned it here at Northwestern.
Thank you so much. I'll get that for you. One other thing is that, again, it helps with the atmospherics of the recording, is if there are various times throughout the evening in which you could applaud spontaneously. And the way that you'll know to applaud spontaneously is I'm pretty much going to give you the signal, could you please clap? So it'll my move tends to be sort of this. So if you see one of those, yeah, we don't need to run it. I think you got it. But we're gonna launch formally the recording part, the part that we edit, in just a minute. But before we do that, I just want to bring our debaters to the stage. Your applause, I'm sure, will not be need to be prompted. So please, let's first welcome our first debater, Mitchell Baker. Next, Tom Wheeler. Nick Gillespie. And Michael Katz. Okay, your applause thing is working exceedingly well, so thank you for that. Whoops. Okay, we're going to officially begin the official program, and it would be great if you could start with a round of applause. Thank you. Between you and the internet stands a company, maybe it is called Verizon or AT&T or Comcast or Cox. That last piece of the pipeline connecting you to the world, it belongs to them, your internet service provider. And in that inescapable relationship, what rights belong to you? What rights belong to them? Net neutrality is the idea, as most people understand it, that ISPs are practically public utilities and should have almost no right to limit where you can go on the internet or the speed at which content creators can get their data to you. They cannot, for example, make you pay more to connect with Facebook or shut you out of Facebook altogether. They can't make Netflix pay extra to move its video at a decent speed, a cost that would surely get passed on to you. The Obama administration liked net neutrality and made it the rule. The Trump administration repealed it, its main argument being that net neutrality is a soft idea, it is unnecessary regulation, and it is detrimental to innovation. So which is it? Well, with lawsuits coming in response to the Trump appeal and actions in at least 20 states across the nation, we think this sounds like it has the makings of a debate. So let's have it. Yes or no to this statement: preserve net neutrality. All data is created equal. I'm John Donvan, and I stand between two teams of two experts in this topic who will argue for and against that resolution. As always, our debate will go in three rounds, and then our audience here at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law in Chicago will choose the winner. And if all goes well, as always, civil discourse will win as well. I just want to remind you, if you haven't yet voted, you have one more chance to cast your first vote. Go to the website on a browser on your mobile device to the site iq2us.org/vote, iq2us.org/vote. You will get prompts to vote for, against, or undecided, which is a perfectly reasonable starting position. We're going to keep that open for just a minute more. And remember, we give victory to the team whose numbers change the most between the first and the second vote. Our motion is this: preserve net neutrality. All data is created equal. Let's meet the team first arguing for the motion, starting, ladies and gentlemen, with Mitchell Baker. Hi, Mitchell. Welcome to Intelligence Squared. You are executive chairwoman of Mozilla, the maker of Firefox. Folks, if you like Firefox, she's on the team that gave it to you. You have been named one of Time Magazine's most 100 most influential people in 2012, inducted into the Internet Hall of Fame. Mitchell, you are often described as an advocate for the open web and open source, but in a sentence or two, what exactly does that mean?
Well, the open source is a really collaborative and sharing development practice, and the open internet is, as we know, the internet that we've been accustomed to. And I'm drawn to them because they have opportunity for all of us.
Okay, thanks very much. And can you please tell us who your partner is tonight?
Yes, my partner is the mighty Tom Wheeler.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Wheeler. So, Tom, you were chairman of the FCC under President Obama. It was during your tenure that net neutrality regulations were put into place. You have also been president of the National Cable Television Association, CEO of Cellular Telecommunications and Internet Association. When President Obama announced your nomination to the FCC, he said you were the Bo Jackson of telecom. For those who don't know, who is Bo Jackson, and what did Obama mean by that?
Well, John, he played here in Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so let's start there. But Bo Jackson, the only professional athlete to play both professional football and professional baseball and be an all-star in both. However, I do think the president was probably engaged in a little over-the-top rhetoric when he said
all right. Thank you. Again, the team, ladies and gentlemen, arguing for the motion. And we have two debaters arguing against it. Please first welcome Nick Gillespie. Nick, welcome back to Intelligence Squared, one of our favorite debaters. You're editor-at-large of Reason, co-host of the Reason podcast, widely seen as one of the foremost libertarians in America. You've been named...
By the way, that's called being damned with faint praise, but thank you very much.
According to your organization's website, you are, quote-unquote, almost certainly the only journalist to have interviewed both Ozzy Osbourne and Nobel laureates like Milton Friedman and Vernon Smith. And recently you sat down with current FCC chairman Ajit Pai. What's the theme that unifies all of these people?
I didn't know this going in, but they have all bitten the heads off of bats.
We did not know that until this moment.
Now it's out.
Nick, tell us, please, who is your partner?
My partner is Michael Katz.
Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Katz. Michael, you are our economist. You're an economics professor at UC Berkeley. During the Clinton administration, you were also at the FCC as chief economist. You served at the Justice Department at Berkeley. You, as I said, you're an economics professor there. But we have a question for you that maybe a lot of people in this room will relate to or not. Can you remember the very first time you had an interaction with the internet?
Barely, because it was over 30 years ago. But it was using something called Gopher. It actually was aptly named because you were burrowing around in the mud to try to find things on the internet, because this was all pre-World Wide Web. And so I'm someone who can testify to you the value of the web and how incredibly more convenient it is and powerful than it was when it started. So it's not just about the underlying infrastructure and the internet, it's about what goes on top of it as well.
Okay, thank you, Michael Katz. And again, the team arguing against the motion. And so to the debate itself, we move on to round one. Round one are opening statements by each debater in turn. They will be 6 minutes each. And Tom, you can make your way to the lectern. Speaking up first for the motion, in support of the motion, preserve net neutrality, all data is created equal, former FCC chairman Tom Wheeler. Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Wheeler.
Thank you. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and we're here to urge you to support the proposition for three simple and straightforward reasons. Number one, the internet is the most powerful and pervasive platform on the planet. It does everything from deliver the world's knowledge to allow us to get a pizza delivered. It has changed our economy. It has changed the way we live each of our lives. But, second point, when we go to access the internet, the company that provides that service is typically a local monopoly. When we were doing our rulemaking, we found that 3/4 of American households had at most one choice when it came to high-speed broadband internet connectivity. And that leads to the third point. You've got a very important and crucial asset in the internet. The access to it is not competitive. Therefore, there needs to be rules. And the question is, who makes the rules? Now, the network providers say, trust us, we'll make the rules. But I think what we'll find in the discussion tonight is that history does not substantiate that trust. You know, Michael was talking about the age of the internet. It's actually about 35 years old. And for the first 25 years, net neutrality reigned. Because we all remember the squeaky, screeching modems that you had to plug into your phone jack in your house to connect your computer to the telephone network to get to the internet. Well, that telephone network was a common carrier. And that meant that it had to take whoever came to it and deliver them to their destination. That's an important point that we'll talk a lot about tonight. This concept of common carrier, which says first come, first serve, non-discriminatory access. And it's only been in the last 8 or 10 years that this whole debate about net neutrality has developed, because when the new digital networks came along, those who owned those networks said, oh, wait a minute, this is different. This is different, and it needs to be regulated differently. And the FCC, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, tried to work its way through that. Let me give you an example. 2007, under a Republican FCC, Comcast decided to degrade the video coming in over the internet that competed with their cable service. The FCC said, no, 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 no. The Republican FCC said, no, no, no. Comcast took him to court and said to the court, hey, we can discriminate because we're not a common carrier. And the court said, you're right, and overruled the FCC. In 2010, when my predecessor came out with the first open internet rule, Verizon sued, went to the court, and stood in the well of the court. And the lawyer said to the judges, I have been instructed by my client that I may say that the reason why we are suing is we intend to discriminate. And there's the key issue in all of this. Should these local companies be allowed to discriminate in access to the most important network of the 21st century? I had the privilege, as John said, of chairing the FCC in 2015. When we said no, you should be a common carrier, and you should provide non-discriminatory access to anyone who wants to get to or from the internet. And that's what the debate is about tonight, because my worthy opponents want us to go back to the bad old days of discrimination. And what we need to be focusing on is a non-discriminatory equal access to the network. One quick closing thought. Last week we saw a lot of discussion about how much information Facebook has about each of us. Facebook is one website. The network that connects you to the internet knows your traffic to every website. Your private information is known by the network, and unless there is common carriage net neutrality, there is no responsibility that they have to protect your privacy. So because of the fact that we don't have a competitive market, because of the fact that history says it worked early on and discrimination happened when it didn't exist, and because of the fact that your privacy ought to be protected, we urge you to strongly and enthusiastically support this resolution tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom Wheeler. Our next debater will be opening against the motion, preserve net neutrality, all data is created equal. He is speaking against. Here is Nick Gillespie, editor-at-large of Reason. Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Gillespie.
Thanks. Wow. Vote against net neutrality. And the reason why is because you remember the Patriot Act, right? The Patriot Act. Who could be against the Patriot Act? It's for patriots. It's good. Net neutrality is good. It's, you know, everybody's neutral, everybody's fair, that's great. We are not so dumb as to think that laws and policies, their names almost always mean the exact opposite thing. And what net neutrality is ultimately about, and I'll go into this in a little bit more detail, and Michael will really drive it home because he's the economist. I don't do math, unfortunately. What net neutrality is about the government being able to say, we get to control your business model. Tom was talking about common carriers. I see a lot of young people out here. I see Acres of Diamonds out here. I see some old people. How many of you remember the great common carrier, Bell Telephone? Okay, a number of you. That's the past. That's the pre-internet past. And when you have common carrier, you get bad service. Do people remember Lily Tomlin, the comedian? She, one of her big bits was that she would be a phone service operator, and she would say, we don't have to give you customer service because we're the phone company, and we don't want to. That's the world of common carrier, as it is historically done. But to go into my prepared remarks, you know, the first thing I want to thank John and IQ Squared for having me back. The first time that I debated in one of these, all I had to do was defend drug dealers, heroin dealers who wanted to put vending machines in grammar schools, things like that. And now it's like they've really made it much harder for me because somehow I have to support ISPs. Do any of you love your ISPs? No, right? I mean, we all hate these types of people. They're necessary evils, but they are businesses, and our lives are better because of the internet, and they are not the problem here. And net neutrality is, in the word of Ajit Pai, the policy of it, not the concept. The policy, Ajit Pai actually told me in an interview in 2014 that it's a solution that won't work to a problem that doesn't exist. And I want to just kind of unpack that in my opening statement. Let's look at first at how it's a problem that doesn't exist. How many of you have had major troubles or persistent troubles of accessing any legal content online? Okay, nobody, right? That's one of, you know, if that would happen, you know, that would be a violation of net neutrality. We have a before, during, and after sequence now because the open internet ruling that Tom put into place was in place for 2 years. We had time before it, during it, and after it. Have you noticed massive changes other than constantly increasing speeds in what you can do online? No. Net neutrality is a concept. It is not a problem. Back in 2004, 2005, Michael Powell, a former FCC commissioner, said, you know, there are basically four freedoms or four rights that define a kind of good internet, an open internet. And they were, among other things, one was the right to access legal content. You have the freedom, the right to access legal content. You have the right to access apps that don't, applications online that don't hurt the network or to put them online. You have the right to attach devices to the network, you know, phone, cameras, all sorts of stuff. Which, by the way, going back to Kalman Carrier, that was one of the things Bell Telephone never let anybody attach anything to the network because it was common carrier. It was a government monopoly, a government-supported monopoly. They got to call all the shots. We have the right to attach devices to the network, and we have the right to get information on our plan. We should be able to talk to our ISPs and say, you know, what's going on? Are you blocking certain sites? Are you changing things up? Are you not allowing me? What are my expected speeds going up and down? Contrary to what Tom said, 98% of Americans, according to the FCC's own data from the end of 2016, 98% of us have a choice of at least two ISPs offering 10 megabyte download speed. That's not great, but it's pretty good. 56% of us, and it's more than enough for virtually everything most of us do, unless you're doing some unauthorized surgery. And if you are, I'm a libertarian, so more power to you, but you probably want to upgrade to a better package. 56% of us have download speeds at 25 megabytes or higher with more than two competing ISPs working for your business. That's very good, and that's up from 40% 6 months before. What we are seeing are more ISPs offering more service to more households at higher speeds. There is not a problem with net neutrality. There is not a problem with throttling or blocking sites. So there isn't a problem. But, well, the solutions to this problem that don't exist, this is why they don't work. In the end, what net neutrality comes down to is the FCC says, under certain types of regulatory laws, we get to regulate your business model. We're not going to tell you whether you're right or wrong, but go ahead and try, and then we'll get back to you. That is an awful, awful way to regulate any kind of business. It chokes off all sorts of innovation, and it ends the sort of permissionless innovation, which is the absolute calling card, both of the internet as well as the sharing economy. I will stop there. Thanks, and again, vote against net neutrality if you believe in free speech, innovation, and a better America.
Thank you, Nick Gillespie. And a reminder of what's going on, we are halfway through the opening round of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan. We have four debaters, two teams of two, fighting it out over this motion: preserve net neutrality, all data is created equal. You've heard the first two opening statements, and now on to the third. Debating in support of the motion, Mitchell Baker, chairwoman of Mozilla. Ladies and gentlemen, Mitchell Baker.
Support net neutrality. It affects the internet and our lives in three ways. One, who decides and controls what we can see and do online? Two, who decides whether new products are successful and what direction innovation takes? Three, it decides the amount of discrimination and self-dealing that sits at the core of the network of everything we do. So first, who decides what we see and can do online? When we click on a link or select an app, what happens? Do we get to see the site or the application we're aiming for, or is it suddenly not available? Without net neutrality, it does not need to be available to you. It's kind of odd to think that part of the internet might not be there, but that's part of the discussion we're talking about. That's called, in the net neutrality world, blocking. Or, when you click on that link or select an app, maybe the site appears, but it's slow. It's really slow. Or the delivery of that information to you is so degraded that it's maybe even unusable, it's too jittery. It's too slow, the application doesn't work. That, in the net neutrality world, is called discrimination, and it is the point of what we're talking about. Now, an ISP, Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, you know, they can discriminate really on any reason. They can discriminate because they own a different product, and they think they'll make more money out of it. That's an innovative business model of the type we just heard about. It is only good for the ISP. Or the ISP could discriminate against the app that you want to access because they have some sort of business arrangement, or maybe they're fighting with the company that makes your app. Or they could discriminate against the app you want to get to because they don't like those kind of apps. You know, they weren't very happy about internet telephony because it didn't make money. Or they could discriminate because they don't like the content. Any of these things are included in the discrimination or the kinds of new business models that our opposition argues for. So, one, our choice as consumers and citizens on the internet gets severely limited without net neutrality. Two, who decides what kind of innovation and new products can be successful? That's the reverse of the topic. Say I'm an app developer and I'm developing something new. Let's say, you know, it's something that's more secure. There's new cryptographic data. I can help you do what you want with your data, but leak less of it, so you control it more. Now, if the ISPs don't need to serve that to you, then I somehow have to find a way that I can make my product available to you. And as John said at the beginning, that way is through the ISP. There is no other way. So before I can offer my product to you, I have to offer it to the ISPs. And I have to convince them or get their approval to deliver it to you. And to deliver it to you quickly enough to make it usable. So now as an app developer, my first customer is not you. My first customer is the ISP. Maybe it wants money. Maybe I can find money and pay them. Maybe it wants data. Like if the ISP doesn't like my product because they competing products give them data, then my product is not good for them. And they can say, I'm not going to deliver it to customers. You know, if you change your data practices, maybe I will. And so in that case, I as the developer cannot make the product I want for you. I cannot make it more secure. And then I have to go to all the other ISPs and have the same discussion. So the ability for innovation to cover a wide range is deeply limited. The lack of net neutrality is great for innovation for the ISPs. 5 companies, even 10 if you double it in America, and it is terrible for all the rest of us. And all the innovative business models that might come out of everyone except the ISPs get limited by what works for the ISPs. And the third question, how much discrimination do we want in the network that is the basis for all of our activities? So Comcast owns NBC. That's a lot of content. The whole point of not having net neutrality is that the ISPs can have, quote, innovative business models, unquote, that benefits the content they like and profit from. So maybe if you're a Comcast subscriber and that's your option, you'll start to see a lot of content that's good for Comcast. If you're an AT&T subscriber, they're trying to buy Time Warner, which includes CNN. So maybe you'll start to get discrimination from AT&T with a different set of content. Or maybe Time Warner can't buy CNN because the government won't let it. Maybe it buys Sinclair News instead. And then if you live in a part of the country where there's AT&T as your choice, and AT&T is discriminating and trying innovative new business models with all the content that it owns, you might very well find your channels of information, including your news, tuned for the new business model that's profitable. Now, sometimes people say to me, oh, that's crazy. You know, businesses wouldn't do that. But, you know, people told me that when I first started talking about the dangers of Facebook and data. And that was nearly a decade ago. And so these sort of crazy businesses would never do that things have a way of happening. And so we are setting the framework right now. It might take another decade for these things to play out, and we see what it looks like to have discrimination built in. But we are making the rules now. Does the next decade play out with a neutral network that delivers information to us based on where we find value? Or does this small set of companies get to pre-select what we see? And so I urge you, I hope you find the preciousness of neutrality in our infrastructure and take action. Support the motion. Support net neutrality. All data is created equal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitchell Baker. And that is the resolution. Preserve net neutrality. All data is created equal. And here to make his opening statement against the motion, Michael Katz, professor at UC Berkeley and former FCC chief economist. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Katz.
Well, you know, advocates of net neutrality are always telling us about the great things it's intended to do, things like promote free speech and competition and innovation. But although I vaguely remember when I first used the internet, I still remember sitting on my grandmother's knee as a small baby, and she said to me, she goes, Michael, the information superhighway to hell is paved with good intentions. Okay. So what I want to do is, instead of talking about intentions, I want to talk about the what net neutrality really does. Okay. Now to do that, we've got to start by dealing with 3 foundational myths behind net neutrality. Myth number 1 is it's necessary to solve problems that would otherwise be there. Now, Nick's already taken care of that one, so how about deal with the other 2? Okay, the second myth is that net neutrality is neutral. Okay, one reason it's a myth is because different applications have different needs from the internet. Video conferencing needs a much higher speed signal and more reliable signal than something like email. So to say we're going to treat them equally is not to treat them equally. It's a much bigger problem for video conferencing. Now, one thing you'll notice, because I sort of go a little bit in back, we were all told to stand on some X's here. And I have tremendous respect for Tom, and I've worked with him over the years, but when he stood out in the middle and he told you that the internet in the good old days was neutral, he was both literally and figuratively off the mark. Okay? Oh, and by the way, for those of you who are younger, literally means literally. Think about the logic. Okay, because the fact is, the NSFNet, the precursor to the commercial internet, prioritized interactive traffic, as it should. Now, there's a second reason that net neutrality is not neutral. We always hear this thing, oh, we need net neutrality because otherwise big, powerful companies will have fast lanes. Well, you know what? They do. And it has nothing, it's nothing net neutrality is going to stop. Google, Facebook, Amazon, they spend literally billions of dollars because they have built private fast lanes. Google has Facebook has proprietary specifications for fiber. They build their own integrated circuits because the servers other people would have to use aren't good enough. So what does net neutrality have to do with this? Well, it ensures that ISPs can't help small firms have higher speed access. So if you have billions to spend on an internet of your own, net neutrality is a great thing, but if you need help, it's a problem. Now, the third myth is that all data are created equal. And I want to contrast two situations. In one, you've got a bunch of kids sitting around, and they're playing Wolfenstein. Now, for those of you who are not up on your classic games, Wolfenstein is a multiplayer game that involves trying to kill Nazis with supernatural powers. The Nazis have the supernatural powers, not you. Okay? So, fine, you're using the internet to do that. Over here, we've got a surgeon who's trying to do remote telesurgery to save somebody's life who lives in a remote area. Surgeon can't get there. According to net neutrality, those two are equally deserving. Okay? I don't subscribe to that view. Okay? All right, so now, those are the myths it's built on. So let's talk about some of the things it does. Well, you know, we've heard a lot of concerns about censorship. Well, frankly, net neutrality is the threat to free speech. Just ask yourself this. Who do you think is a bigger threat to access to CNN.com and WashingtonPost.com? Is it an ISP that makes money because you pay it because you want to get access to this site? Or is it the Trump administration? Because what net neutrality is about is giving the Trump administration more power over the internet that those websites depend on. Hey, let's talk about some other things it does. Competition. What you'll hear from net neutrality supporters is you've got to block competition to protect it. Yes, that is an oxymoron. Now, what do I mean by that? Because they say, well, we can't have firms paying more money in order to bring better services to their customers. That would be terrible. Well, let's think about what net neutrality would mean in other circles. Let's think about, say, Amazon or online providers. It would mean they can't provide free overnight shipping. Why? That's not fair. That's a fast lane. Or just think about any firm that wanted to do advertising, say on Google or Facebook. Well, you can't allow that. That's paying for superior access to customers. We can't have people paying for superior access to customers. So what net neutrality is really about when it comes to competition is blocking it, okay, not promoting it. Similarly, let's talk about low-income consumers. People have said, oh, we need to have net neutrality to protect people with low incomes. Well, it has the opposite effect. Net neutrality, right, well, if it's enforced, and sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, when it's enforced, what does it do? It says, if a content provider, an app provider, wants to help subsidize the internet for low-income people, violation of net neutrality. And what about rural consumers? The way rural areas are going to get coverage is only if ISPs invest in the facilities. Well, what makes them invest in the facilities? Possibility of making money. If you impose open-ended and vague regulations that constrain these firms in known and unknown ways, you are reducing their incentive to invest in those rural areas. So when you think about it, look beyond what net neutrality is intended to do, and you look at what it does do, you'll see that it harms competition, it harms consumers, it limits choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael Katz. And that concludes round one of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is preserve net neutrality, all data is created equal. Now we move on to round two, and round two is where the debaters address one another directly by taking questions from me and from you, our live audience here in Chicago. Our motion is preserve net neutrality. All data is created equal. We have two teams debating this motion, the team representing the for side, Mitchell Baker and Tom Wheeler. We have heard them argue that the internet represents a pervasive and powerful force in life, but that it's always, almost always functioning as a local monopoly. They're arguing that the bad old days of discrimination are what their opponents want to go back to. They are arguing also that the situation is not competitive, that three quarters of U.S. households have at most one choice for speed. They talk about the potential for ISPs in a world without net neutrality to block and discriminate. They call an absence of net neutrality actually an innovation killer because it gives ISPs the power to hold app developers hostage and customers hostage to their content. So that's the team arguing for the motion, some of their argument. Now their opponents, Nick Gillespie and Michael Katz, describe net neutrality as a concept for rather than a problem, and it's a problem that does not actually exist. They're suggesting that the record shows that over the course of the history of the internet during periods when there was not net neutrality, these companies did not do the bad things that their opponents are saying that they would do. They're also arguing that, in fact, data is not created equal, that the needs of video and email are quite different from one another. They make an example, for example, of what they say is the anti-competitive nature of the net neutrality rules, pointing out, for example, that an ISP, if it wanted to, could not subsidize low-income users to get greater speed because that would be breaking the rules. So there's a lot here and many, many themes developing. There's the question of whether these ISPs should be seen as a utility or not. There's the question of consumer choice. There's the question of fairness. And a little bit came up about free speech, and we'd like to get to all of those. But I want to first get a little bit into and then quickly out of the way something of a technical question. And there was a real stark disagreement on this question of whether this actually is a competitive landscape or whether these ISPs are functionally monopolies. And the two sides had very, very different numbers. And it may just emerge that you're going to have different numbers and we can't resolve that. But I would like to just take 30 seconds from each of you to tell us where your numbers came from and restate, Tom, what you say is the degree of choice that internet users have.
So one of the things you want to make sure you don't do, John, is you don't want to fudge the count to get to the right answer. When I said three quarters of American homes had at most one choice for high speed, that's 25 megabits per second and above. Mm-hmm. What Nick did was, first of all, lower the speed, which to his credit, he said, oh, this is only 10 and this really doesn't count.
He did say that, yes.
Okay, to his credit, okay? But then he went the next step and talked about, but at 25 megahertz, there's a different number.
56% of
that number is calculated this way. You know, if you and I were to sit down and we say, how many people in the audience? We'd go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The way that number was calculated is the FCC came up with this concept that let's look at a census block. That part of the audience right over there. And if these two people in the front row have high-speed connectivity, then everybody in that entire census block has high-speed connectivity. And that is an assumption that is fallacious.
Okay, Nick.
So when you were head of the FCC, you changed the definition of what counted as high-speed broadband. He changed it from 10 megabytes downstream to 25 megabytes downstream. You would, and I don't think I'm putting
actually
words.
Actually, changed it from 4 to 25.
Right. Okay. But
because
yes.
That's what you need in order to have high-speed service, and it's
well,
what
no, okay, no,
Tom,
no, no.
Tom,
but
Tom, let me have the floor.
Is what I'm saying is what Tom thinks high-speed internet is 25 megabytes per second. The average number that normally gets kicked around is about 18 megabytes downstream. How many of you are gamers or pretty heavy gamers? God, this is the deadest audience. You're still talking.
It's about 3%, just for people who are not watching.
But 10 megabytes is actually a pretty fast connection. You can game on 10 megabytes. And what I was saying is 98%, everybody in America has a choice of at least two fixed ISPs for that amount. And that is going up. When you go to 25 megabytes, the number goes down, but there is still competition, and it is growing.
Okay, I want to move off this, but Michael, I'll give you 10 seconds on this.
I defend myself. It was Wolfenstein classic. Yes. But this is the thing. I will say, because I'll dump on everybody, because that's what economists do. You're both stuck in the past. And this thing about the speeds. 5G is coming. When 5G comes, we're talking about having hundreds of megabits per second, and we're talking about having multiple providers, if that investment occurs and net neutrality doesn't stop it.
Okay.
There's no point in looking
back. All right,
back.
But the resolution is that you're both talking about variable speeds, and so that tells us to some degree why you're coming up with different numbers, and I just wanted to get clarity
but it is,
for myself
but it,
on that.
It is very important to say that that ISPs have a monopoly is absolutely wrong, and I think we all know that.
Let me ask Mitchell Baker.
But there's also mobile carriers that come into
Let me ask Mitchell Baker, do you see ISPs as having a monopoly?
Yes, because the question of monopoly is not whether there's two or three networks, there's what's actually available to you in your region at the time. So
yeah, and if there's two or three.
Wait, Nick, let her finish, please.
Yeah.
Go. Are you done?
Yes.
So he jumped in just when you were interrupting, and then I protected you.
That's
and
okay.
You were the embodiment of net neutrality.
Can I tag on to my partner?
I am the embodiment of net neutrality.
Yes.
Actually, I want to take my
regulation.
All right, Tom.
Can I tag on to my partner?
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating that the ISPs are out running commercials saying, because you have so many different devices in your home, you need to buy from us faster service. And that disagrees with Nick's concept that, oh, you only need this low level of activity. Because as we all have more devices in the home, the demand for throughput out of that home increases. The companies are selling that. And I think, by the way, that you ought to pay more for that. That I've always felt that, you know, 12 pounds of tomatoes ought to cost more than 10 pounds
so
of tomatoes.
Tom, do you agree, though, that, I mean, is the figure that essentially 100% of Americans have two or more ISPs to get 10 megabytes from? That there is a thriving market. And by the way, that a monopoly, you can't have two firms and call it a monopoly.
Duopoly.
Okay, no, but, they are, you know, Coke and Pepsi. Coke and Pepsi, you know, Republicans and Democrats.
So the reality,
increase their speed.
But they aren't. So here's the point, Nick. That
why
would for
three they?
Years, for 3 years, we have had an open internet rule in place. Consumers have been protected. The networks have expanded their investment. The networks have had record profits and record stock prices. And if all those can happen together, where the networks succeed and consumers are protected, that's a win-win kind of a situation.
Okay, 1 second. I'm going to let Nick respond, but the two people whose names begin with M, we're not hearing very much from them. So please respond, Nick, and then I want to bring in Michael and Mitch.
You know, the open internet era lasted for a couple of years. If you look at the increase in the number of connections,
But take a second to remind people what you mean by that era, 2015 to 2018.
Okay. Beginning of this year. You know, what you look, if you go back, if you take a trend line and you run it 10 years, 20 years, however, the increase in speed, the increase in availability keeps going up. The one thing that does change, and these are numbers, and I know Tom and I disagree about this, according to the U.S. Telecom Association, the actual investment flatlined during the open internet era because the regulations were not clear. It wasn't exactly what's going on, and this is what economic theory predicts. When you have vague regulations and you're not sure if they're going to stick around or if they're a good idea, you don't put in as much.
Now, let me, I want to bring Mitchell into the conversation. Yeah. Do you want to respond to that point? Because I do have another thing I want to move on to.
Let's move on.
Okay, I want to take your point about the potential bad behavior of companies when they're not, to some degree, limited by net neutrality. The things that you talked about, the discrimination, the blocking, and the detrimental impact that you said that would have on innovation, to Michael Katz. So you heard a sort of very negative potential scenario, and I think, in fact, some examples that support Mitchell's case would be, you know, the time AT&T decided to block FaceTime because they didn't like people getting around their bills by using FaceTime, and they did stop doing that. But that's an example of the kind of thing she's talking about, that the ISPs in a post-net neutrality world would be off to the races. I want to have you respond to that and then have Mitchell respond to what you say.
Well, first off, I don't want to comment on a specific case because one of the things I've always said about antitrust cases and others is the people who know enough to talk about it know they have to keep quiet because they have confidential information. And the people who do talk about it are the people who know so little that they're free to do it. And that's not a slight Mitchell, but I just don't want to get into the specifics of it. You're not the one who brought it up. He did.
Did you say
no, I just want to be clear. I'm not going
to. But to the degree you're talking about the future.
No, but let's talk about this thing about innovation, though, and this the broader argument about permissionless innovation, but also this thing about specific. Because there, the allegation in that case that it was to block competition.
Okay, but
that's what the antitrust law.
We don't have to talk about that case.
Okay, that's what the antitrust.
He's talking about a sense of motives affecting behavior.
But talking about. You know, this whole thing it's talking about often saying, well, permissionless innovation, and this is really bad. To innovate, you know, you'll have to get the permission of the ISP. Well, you know what? You also have to get the permission of the electricity company.
But that's not true, Mike.
You
that's
know.
Not
It's exactly
close.
The same.
There
Wait, let's
no
talk about
permission.
What we're talking about.
Wait, hang on a second. I want to let Michael, like, get through a point.
Okay. You have to
And
pay
then
your
I would
electricity
like to have your
bill. Now, one thing, here's the problem. With net neutrality, people just throw everything into it. I agree. Okay, if the discrimination is that you say this particular company, all right, just because of who you are, we're going to go after you. But the problem with net neutrality is it says, suppose I have something completely neutral that says if you want to buy faster speed, you pay more. It doesn't matter who you are. Net neutrality makes that kind of tiered pricing, or what I'll call it variety, it makes that illegal. I agree with you.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Like I said, the ISP, £12 ought to cost
Tom,
more than £10.
Tom,
okay,
let your
but
partner
net
have
neutrality a says no. that you cannot buy faster access if you're a content provider.
Mitchell.
All right, I want to come back to a couple conversations. One, none of us goes to the power company to ask if we can build something that plugs into a socket. Right, you build something that's safe and is according to the safety specs. So the idea that we ask for permission with electricity.
Okay, where's the permission with the internet?
So let me finish. Second, to your point, which is about trust, or what do we think the companies are going to do? And that I think we should expect the great businesses of America to pursue their business. And that we should trust companies to try and maximize their business, be successful, and maximize their profits. That's why they're businesses. That's what they are supposed to do. And so if we're going to trust them, that's what we should trust. And without net neutrality, we are being explicit that one way to maximize your business is these innovative business models that charge products or applications or new applications based on how profitable they are. Mm-hmm. So the fact they haven't done it yet, well, the last few years have been under the open internet order. And in the earlier days, like, it wasn't as easy. The technology to inspect applications and understand it wasn't as well deployed.
So do you consider it kind of a foregone conclusion that given the chance to play these games, the ISPs are going to play these games?
Well, without net neutrality, it is not a game. It is the law.
Right.
Given
no,
a chance
but
you to
are
maximize
but
your business,
what
you
parade,
will do so.
Let's bring
this,
in Nicolas.
This parade of horribles is, at this point, hypothetical. Because you're saying, yeah, it's going to be down the road. You even said in your opening statement, it might be 10 years down the road, we'll see this.
10
this
years down the road, it becomes clear what has happened. Just as
no, but
the issues
it is not
with
happening.
Data are
it
clear.
Did not happen before the net neutrality rules were in place, and it has not started happening just yet. And think, you know, think about, we all know whenever a new medium comes out, people think, oh, it's all totally different. And so do you remember like the Craigslist killings, which, you know, where somehow when old people would get together in personal ads and somebody would commit a crime on that, it was like, okay, that was one thing. But when it happened on Craigslist, because that was an online service, people were like, oh my God, the internet is evil, blah, blah, blah. There's this whole kind of internet exceptionalism, which I think is at work in kind of your formulation.
Oh, see,
wait.
Opposite.
But of things, because what you're saying is that, say, Comcast does an ISP or a particular ISP, they are going to screw over anybody who competes with their own products. That would be like saying you go to Kroger or to a grocery store. And why would Kroger ever sell anybody else's product? Why wouldn't they just sell house brand stuff?
I have the results. Again, the way this works, it's the numbers, it's the difference between the first and the second vote. The team whose numbers have gone up the most in percentage points will be declared our winner. Again, the motion is this: preserve net neutrality, all data is created equal. Before the motion, in polling the